Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Jeremy continues our series called Surrounded as we look at what siege warfare looked like in the ancient times. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Jeremy.
Good morning, South Harbor. My name's Jeremy. I'm one of the pastors here. And so before we get into anything, like how we feel about the Lions draft this week? All right. It was like, we got some claps. All right. It was like the first year ever I came into it going, I know the positions we need. And we actually drafted the positions I thought we needed. So I don't know if that's a good thing, a bad thing. I know it's a thing, but all it means is that football's coming, right? Let's go. So I'm excited to be here with you. We are in week two of a sermon series we then started last week that we're calling Surrounded. And in this story, what's up, bud? In this sermon series, what we're doing is we're kind of holding two things in tension right next to each other, kind of two stories. One, we're looking at one of the biggest events that the Jewish people, when if they look back and said, okay, we're going to tell you our story, we're going to describe our history, there are two events that they would point to as things that had kind of shaped them. One is something that we looked at for about a year when we looked at the story of the Exodus, is the Exodus, when they were slaves in Egypt. They were slaves in Egypt, and God would set them free. So one was the Exodus. The other they would point at is what we know as the exile. The exile is something I think we know less about than we do the Exodus. But the exile, the story we're specifically looking at, is what we call the Babylonian exile. So under King David, Israel was one nation, kind of made up of 12 tribes. It's one nation under King David, one nation under David's son Solomon. But then under Solomon's son, then the nation's going to divide. You're going to have a north and a south. The north is 10 tribes, the south is 2. What we know is that it'll kind of go this way for a few hundred years, and then the north will be conquered by an empire, a nation called Assyria. They'll get hauled off. The north is essentially gone. So all we have left are the two tribes in the south. They'll kind of make it for another couple hundred years until Babylon is going to come in. We have the Babylonian exile. And so what I want to do this morning is kind of hold these two things side by side. The Babylonian exile, what happened? Last week we talked about kind of the things before the attack. This week, today, I want to look at what happened kind of during the attack. What did that look like? So we want to look at the exile. But then I also want to ask the question, how can we learn from that story so that we are prepared in the places in our life where it feels like the walls are pressing in on us? When we're in those spaces where it feels like the dream has fallen apart, where the diagnosis gets named, when the future that we had hoped for doesn't feel like the future we're stepping into, and we feel like we're in that space where like the bottom's dropped out, where we feel like the walls are pressing in. What do we do? How do we move forward, and how can we learn from their story? And so last week, we looked at kind of the question, like, is there could they have seen it coming? Right? Were they surprised when the Babylonians came? Could they have known it was coming? And last week we spent some time looking at kind of those, like, there were some lights blinking on the dashboard, right? Like we looked at the prophets. We talked about prophets are less future tellers than they were like truth tellers. That prophets would often speak truth to power, naming that, okay, this is where we're at. And if we continue in the direction that we're moving, these are the natural implications that are going to come. Prophets weren't trying to predict a future. If anything, they were trying to change the future. They were naming that, like, this is their direction we're heading. If we keep going, this is what happens. But there's still time. We can turn. We can change. If we give ourselves to the things that matter, that future that looks like it's where we're heading, that doesn't have to be our reality. And so last week, we looked at kind of those lights that were blinking on the dashboard. A Babylon's coming. And yet in our story, those blinking lights, those warnings were largely just kind of pushed aside. They were not followed. But this morning, I want to look at kind of what happens during. And one of the things we're going to see is that one of the things that is going to help in our story is actually something that a group of people did about 100 years earlier. Because this isn't the only time in our story that a foreign enemy, that a foreign empire is going to attack. About 100 years earlier, there was a warning. Hey, people are coming. Not Babylon, but Assyria. And in that story, 100 years earlier, they are going to respond. They're going to respond in a way that saves them and helps in our story, but I think the way they respond isn't a way that I think we're going to assume, that the way they respond, what saves them, what helps us, is essentially they're going to grab a bunch of shovels. They're going to grab a bunch of shovels. It's going to save them. It's going to help us in our story. And I think when we actually step back and ask what they were doing with those shovels, what we might learn is that what might help us the most in our stories, especially when those walls are pressing in, is also maybe grabbing a bunch of shovels. And so what I want to do is I want to start in the same space that we started last week, Daniel chapter 1. Daniel kind of gives an overview, kind of a 30,000-foot snapshot of the Babylonian exile. Daniel 1, he says it this way in verse 1. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God, those he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. So Babylon comes in, fights against Jerusalem. Babylon's going to, according to Daniel 1, Babylon's going to win. But what I want to do is I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what did that battle look like? Because I think what that battle looked like, I think, is different than most of our mental images of especially like ancient warfare. Most of your movies are going to look like an older version of like, I'll never forget when I was a kid and I first learned like how they used to fight, like in the Civil War, World War, like they would literally take a field, line up people on either side and muskets, and it's almost like this dark form of bowling, right? It was terrible. Blew my mind. And yet, most of the movies still, like, all you need is William Wallace yell freedom, and like, it's on, and you just have groups of people running at each other in a field. Now, I'm not saying that didn't happen, but in the ancient world, especially if you wanted to take a city, if you wanted to, say you're Nebuchadnezzar, you want to take Jerusalem, what you don't do is just meet a bunch of people in a field and have at. There's a different way, a kind of a different military strategy that you would employ. And it's right there in our verse. So it says Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So I want to talk a little bit about kind of the ancient kind of military strategy of siege warfare. You're an empire. You want to conquer a city. What do you do? How do you do it? And in order to talk about that, about siege warfare, about how to take a city, I first want to talk about why you would have a city where you would have it. And so I want you to kind of put a hat on. Pretend you live in the ancient world. You are the leader of your people. They're your family, they're your community, extended family, but they look to you. You're the one that's in charge. And you need to find a place for your people to settle. You need to build a city. And so I'm going to use a little bit of AI imaging this morning. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I asked AI to draw me a picture of a mountain, kind of a region, kind of right in that central mountain region of Israel, kind of right around the type of area where Jerusalem is. And it spit out, it's a decent looking image, isn't it? I was happy with it. So I'm going to grab my laser pointer. You are a ancient like civil engineer, a city planner. Your family's looking to you. If you're in this region, you have a couple options for where you would build a city, right? Where would you do it? What feels like a good spot to build a city in the image? You got kind of got two options. You could build on most of the mountains are kind of like just big hills, right? But you could build on the mountain, or you could build in the flatland. Where are you going to build? in the ancient world, they almost always had an answer. You build high. Question, why? Why would you build up there? Yeah, so I would argue there's kind of two major reasons you build up high. One of them is around kind of military, especially around defense. That if an enemy's going to come, if Babylon's going to attack, are you more likely to see them earlier if you're up high or you're down below? If you're up high, right? So you get a better perspective. You get to see the landscape better. If somebody's coming, if something's happening, you can see it. And you're able to defend yourself better if you're up high. You're in the ancient world, you're going to build your city with walls. And so if you're elevated, in order to attack your city, not only do you need to scale the mountain, but now there's walls on top of the mountain. And the whole time your enemy's coming to you, you have options. We have stories in our Old Testament of like people dying from like millstones being thrown from a city wall. So you can throw rocks, you can shoot things, you can throw all kinds of things down at the enemy. You're better defended. So there's a military reason to be up here. I would argue there's also not military, but just kind of like a how do you live in this area in the ancient world? Anybody like have a farm or like you've got like the little garden that you farm on? A couple of us? If you're going to farm, in this region of the world, your mountain, like most mountains are mostly made out of rocks. Your valley, the flatland, is going to be where your topsoil is. Where do plants grow quickest? In the valleys, in the flatland. And so if you build up here, there is a military strategy. Yeah, you can see further, you're more defendable. And you then, if you build your city down here, you're living in the places where your people need, like, could be growing food. So you live up here, you then farm this land, and then you bring your food up to the mountain. Does this make sense? There's always going to be exceptions, but most of your big cities in the ancient world were built this way. Tim and I have had the opportunity to lead a handful of biblical study tours. We actually get to leave 2 weeks from tomorrow to lead one to Turkey and Greece. And so 2 weeks from Wednesday, we're going to be at this mountain. It's the ancient city of Pergamum. It's a mountain a lot like our mountain. This mountain, where do you think the city was? Right up on top, a rendition. So you have the city up on top. People might live on kind of the slopes. You've got your walls to the city. And so if an enemy comes, if you're who's who enough, if you make it on time, you can flee from the kind of villages into the city walls, and you now stay in the city. Does this make sense? So if we go back to our hill, our little hill in the central valleys of Jerusalem, do we agree we're going to build on top of the city, or on top of the mountain? We good? All right. We have a city on top of our mountain. So this is where you live. You farm the valleys. You live up there. You can see enemies coming. You have a better defense system. There are all kinds of reasons. So now, put yourself in the shoes of Nebuchadnezzar. You no longer live in the city. You are now in charge of an army. You want to take the city. What options do you have? Well, one, I mean, what we often see in the movies is like you take a battering ram and you go to the door and the gate, right? Or you build a bunch of ladders and you put those up against the wall and you try to scale it. But if you're Nebuchadnezzar, you're a good general, you know that, yeah, that might work, but that strategy is also going to be costly. You're going to lose some troops because as you're bringing things up to the gate, to the walls, they're there for a reason. They're going to be attacking you. You're going to lose some of your people. As a good general, you decide that doesn't feel like a great strategy. And so at some point, we don't know exactly like what people group it started with or who came up with the idea, but at some point, somebody took a look at this scenario and, okay, how could we defeat the city while losing as few of our own troops as possible? If we attack the wall, if we try to break in, we probably lose some people. How else could we do it? And then what they realized is if you're on top of a mountain, right, you're in the city, you're walled in, and if their food is all down here, somebody had an idea. How could you defeat the city? Well, they decided you don't actually have to attack the city. All you have to do is surround the city in a way that you can cut the city off from its life source, from its food source, from its... Do you often find water on the top of a mountain or down in the valley? Down in a valley. And so what they found, what they decided is if we simply surround the city, we can stay a safe enough distance from the walls that they can't hit us from anything they could either shoot or throw from on top of the wall, and we just wait. I asked Google, how long could somebody inside that city wall, how long if you don't have access to food, how long can you live? It's about 3 months is about the furthest you could make it. So if you, as an army laying siege on a city, this is what we call siege warfare, surrounding a city and cutting it off from its supplies. If you cut them off from their food, you just wait for about 3 months, and then there's nobody left to defend it. You just go on in. But if you can cut them off from their water supply, food will be about 3 months, water about 3 days. And so with siege warfare, all you do, surround the city, and you wait. If they're still there in 4 days, if there's still activity, okay, they must have some amount of water in the city, and then you just wait. If there's still activity in the city 4 months later, they must have some sort of food in the city, and you just wait, because at some point, they're going to run out. Siege warfare, in a lot of ways, when I first learned it, it even helped me make sense of some other Bible stories, some other, especially like Old Testament stories, some of them that I'd grown up with or that I'd sang songs about, right? Like, anybody ever sing songs of like, Joshua fought the battle of Jericho and the walls came a-tumbling down, right? That story, the story of Jericho, starts by the gates of Jericho were securely barred because the Israelites were attacking the city. No one went out and no one came in. Then the Lord said to Joshua, see, I've delivered Jericho into your hands along with its king and its fighting men. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days on the seventh. So the whole time, my kid brain, like, why are they just like, why is there a parade around this ancient walled city, right? What are we doing? But what they're doing is they're laying siege to Jericho. They have the thing surrounded. They've cut it off from its food, from its water supplies. This is what they're doing. So in the ancient world, siege warfare was really less about kind of like a one-day attack, and it was more of a slow, sustained loss of hope for the people in the city walls. Right? It's not like one day you're free and you're fine, and the next day Babylon is forcing their way in and everything's changed. What happens is one day you're fine and life is normal, and the next day you're surrounded and you have no longer any access to the things that you need to stay alive. And so what siege warfare does is the days after are almost as hard as the day of, right? There's the moment it happens, and then there's every day afterwards where you're trying to figure out how long can we make it? How are we going to get through this? What are we going to do? And in the days afterwards, there's almost like this slow, gradual loss of hope. See, I think for many of us, when we're in those spaces in our lives where it feels like the walls are pressing in, right? When it's in those moments when you were told the diagnosis or they left or something has happened. There's like the moment it happened, right? The moment you learn something, the moment it happens. And that's unbelievably painful. And then often there's those moments afterwards when you're trying to adjust to this new reality of like what is and what's real and how do I live in this space? And for some of us, the hardest part is those days afterwards, especially if we start buying the lies that it'll never get better, that this is how it is, that this is just what it's going to look like. Siege warfare, it was a moment, but then it was all those moments after that moment. So then the question, what do you do? What do you do? How do you make it through? How do you move forward? Because if you're somebody who's living in the walls, right, you're living in the walls, you have to have some sort of response, right? Like, a response is you just avoid it. You just pretend it's not happening, right? It's easier just to not think about it. Can we name that gets you nowhere, right? That gets you nowhere. And yet, I think if we're honest, sometimes when we're in those spaces where it feels like life is pressing in on us, some of us, our first response is just to pretend it's not there, just to keep moving, just keep going, just pretend it's not a thing. In siege warfare, that gets you nowhere. I think some of us have realized that in life, that gets us a similar space. So you have to do something. Okay, so what you could do is we could decide, if we're in that city wall, we could decide we're going to try to go out and fight. But what happens? You're surrounded by an army. The moment, let's pretend we're going to go out the gate. What happens the moment you open the gate? They start pressing in, right? Okay, so what if we try to find a way over the wall? But then what you find is you're surrounded, army in front of you, wall behind you, not a good spot. That's also not a great way to go. So what's your best option? You're in the city, you're surrounded. One of the best things you could do, one of the things that they would often do, is you would hope. Maybe because you're in that elevated position, you saw them coming. Maybe somebody you know let you know that the Babylonians are coming. Your hope is that before they get there and surround your city, your hope is that you could send a person, a small group of people, as kind of runners. And the hope is you could send them out, and the hope is they could get to one of your allies, a nation that you're tight with. And the hope is those nations hear that, like, Babylon's coming, and they say, oh, we're going to help. And your hope is they bring an army together, and that army comes and kind of attacks the sieging army from behind to open it up so you can get out of your city. Does that make sense? In a siege, if you don't rely on your community, if you don't rely on your people, on your allies, if you just say, oh, we're going to be fine, I would argue that in a siege, isolation in a lot of ways is surrender. You need your allies. You need your community. You need somebody to come help you because you can't help yourself. Now, I wonder, started thinking about us, about me, about what happens when we're in those spaces, and when it feels like we're surrounded, when it feels like life is pressing in on us, like the pressure's building. I think, unfortunately, for so many of us, our default response isn't to reach out, but too often, I think, our default response is to kind of withdraw and to isolate and to think we can go it alone. It's that moment when like the marriage is straining and you pull back from the people that are closest to you. It's that moment when those dark clouds start to settle in, and instead of reaching out to somebody who cares about you, letting them know what's going on and how you're feeling, instead you stop responding to the text messages. Right? It's the moment when you lose the job, and so what you do is you then don't show up at the next function or the next gathering because you're afraid somebody's going to ask you about it, and then what are they going to think if they find out? Are they going to change the way they look at me? I don't want to have to deal with explaining it. And so the question, why is it that so often for us, when our walls are pressing in, do we, instead of reaching out, do we isolate, do we withdraw? And I think there's a handful of potential reasons. I think one of them might have to do with this idea of shame. That shame is a feeling that, shame is one of the core feelings that psychologists will say all of us at some point are going to feel. And shame, I would argue, has a voice. And one of the things shame whispers to us is it whispers to us the lies that if they, whoever they are, if they ever find out about what's going on, about what you're feeling, about what's happening to you, they are going to reject you. They are going to look down on you. They are going to withdraw from you. And what happens too often is if we believe the lies that shame tells us, shame essentially causes us to almost like pre-reject ourselves out of a fear that they might reject us if they ever found out. And so when we buy the lie, we isolate and we pull back. There's a speaker, author, researcher, specializes on shame. Her name is Brené Brown. If you've not read Brené Brown, like Brené Brown's brilliant. Brené Brown says this. She says, shame hates it when we reach out and tell our story. It hates having words wrapped around it. It can't survive being shared. Shame loves secrecy. When we bury our story, the shame metastasizes. It just grows. Too often, I think we buy that lie. We listen to shame and we respond accordingly. And then I think there's a couple other things that go on. I think for some of us, the reason we isolate is maybe around a feeling of fear. Right? Maybe it's a fear that if I share, like, am I going to be a burden to the people around me? Like, it's my story, it's not theirs. I don't have, like, what's going to happen if I share it? Or the fear of how are they going to respond? How are they going to react? How are they going to treat me? Is it going to change things? I think fear drives. I think there's also, especially in our world, in our culture today, I wonder if we don't, misunderstand this idea. We think that, like, independence means strength, right? If I can take it on my own, if I'm strong enough, I should be able to do it by myself, right? I should be able to take it on. I can handle it. I can go at my, I don't need anybody. I can just do it alone. And for some reason, I think we buy the lie that being able to do it alone, that's what strength looks like. When the reality, if I think of the people that I know in my life, I would not say that the strongest people I know are the people who never feel any need for anybody around them, that just do everything by themselves. I would say, in my life, the people that I know who I would say are the strongest are sometimes the ones that are humble enough to recognize that there are moments they cannot go it alone, and they need people around them to carry them when they can't walk on their own. I wonder. And then I wonder sometimes if shame, if pain, if these things aren't lying to us and telling us those things that, like, this is just how it is. It's never going to get better. This is just what it's going to be like. And if we buy those lies, we end up withdrawing from the people around us who might be able to care for us and help us in the midst of it. I actually, it's not lost on me that during a siege, right, during siege warfare, the very first thing an enemy tries to do is cut you off from your life sources, cut you off from water, cut you off from food. The moment they can cut you off, they know they've got you. And I wonder too often when we're in spaces when we feel like life is pressing in. I wonder if we aren't too quick to cut ourselves off from the life sources, from the things that might be able to help us in those spaces. So Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar's coming in. Babylon is laying siege. They've got the city surrounded. If there's a hope, it probably doesn't come from how they're able to respond in the walls. It's probably them being able to reach out to a friend. What we find is Jerusalem was actually able to do it. They got word out. They got word out one of their allies, an unlikely ally, is actually going to come help. We actually read about it in Jeremiah 37. Jeremiah 37 says, Pharaoh's army, hold on, who? Pharaoh's armies had marched out of Egypt. And when the Babylonians, who were besieging Jerusalem, heard the report about them, they withdrew from Jerusalem. Who comes to Jerusalem's aid? Pharaoh in Egypt. Then the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Tell the king of Judah who sent you to inquire of me, Pharaoh's army, which has marched out to support you, will go back to its own land, to Egypt. Then the Babylonians will return and attack the city. They will capture it and burn it down. This is what the Lord says. Do not deceive yourselves thinking the Babylonians will surely leave us. They will not. Even if you were to defeat the entire Babylonian army that is attacking you and only wounded men were left in their tents, they would come out and burn the city down. It's a rough message. But Jeremiah essentially says, yes, the Egyptians are going to come, and they are going to break up the siege. Babylon's going to withdraw. But don't think it's over, because Babylon is going to come back. 2 Kings 25 tells us that story, that yes, Babylon comes back. 2 Kings 25, notice if any details jump out at you in this. It says, so in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with his whole army. He encamped outside the city and built siege works all around it. the city was kept under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. Anybody notice anything? From what year to what year? From the 9th year to the 11th year? And then if you start playing with like days and months, what you find is that Jerusalem was under siege by the Babylonians during that time of Zedekiah for 18 months. You can live without food for 2, maybe 3. You could stretch it to 3. You can live without water for about 3 days. And Jerusalem was under siege for 18 months, which tells you what? They found a way to bring food and water inside the city, right? How in the world do you last 18 months? Somehow they figured something out. And that somehow was actually a whole bunch of hard work that was done by a group of people 100 years earlier. That 100 years earlier, there were prophets that stood up. There were warning signals. The lights on the dash were blinking. Not Babylon. Babylon won't come for another 100 years. But in this story, Assyria is coming. They're coming. And in our story, the king heard that Babylon's coming and decided to do nothing. 100 years earlier, they got the message that Assyria is coming, and that king decided to do something. That king's name is Hezekiah, and Hezekiah recognized he had a problem. He understands siege warfare. He knows that's what the Assyrians are going to do, and Hezekiah realizes he has an issue. If I put up a model, this is a part of a model of Jerusalem. It's in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. But this area right here is kind of the older chunk of Jerusalem. It's called the City of David. The palaces would have been kind of in this region. Hezekiah, king of Jerusalem at the time, he knows his problem when Assyria shows up. This is kind of a replication in the model of the Kidron Valley. The Mount of Olives would be over here. Hezekiah knows the water supply for Jerusalem exists in the Kidron. It's a place called the Gihon Spring. It's outside of the city walls. So Hezekiah knows when Assyria shows up, they're going to cut him off from his water supply. Without water, he has 3 days. Maybe a little bit longer if they're able to store some. And so Hezekiah realizes before Assyria is able to get there, he says, okay, we need to do something. And so what Hezekiah did is something that will save him, something that will help in our story, something I don't know that any of us would have expected. Hezekiah said, okay, the way we do this is we grab a bunch of shovels. And what Hezekiah did is he put a team by the Gihon Spring, and he put a team of people in the city walls of Jerusalem, and he had them dig down, and then he had them start digging towards each other. It is a massive feat. It's a crazy feat. This tunnel that they will build, we know it as Hezekiah's tunnel, is not a straight line. There are stories. Our world has just built some tunnels, and it's using lasers and GPS and all this modern technology. Hezekiah had none of that, and the tunnel wasn't straight. If we go to the next picture, the tunnel kind of resembles this weird curvy S-shaped thing. No idea how they did it. Maybe they followed a crack in the rock. Maybe they, we have maybes. We have no idea. But what we know is one team started in the Gihon, the other started in Jerusalem, and we know that they met. We actually, on all of our Israel trips, we've been able to bring people to walk Hezekiah's tunnel. You come down these stairs. The whole thing is filled with water. The next picture I took. So you're walking through water, ankle to kind of mid-thigh deep-ish. And to get kind of a picture of scale, the Reverend Timothy Wilson took that photo. I should be a photographer. That's a pretty comfy, spacious region in that tunnel. There are spots in the tunnel where you are literally like you're crouched over and kind of crooked because the thing is that tight, and the whole time you're knee deep in water. It's awesome. It's awesome. And every year there's some claustrophobic, like, just keep talking. I just can't think about where I'm at. But what we know is Hezekiah had one group start in the Gihon, one group start in Jerusalem, and they met. And there's actually a place in the tunnel. They've actually carved it out. But right there is what we know as the Siloam inscription. It essentially says, like, this is the space where we were digging from one side and we could hear the voices of those on the other, and we were only a couple meters away, and this is where we broke through and the tunnel connects. Hezekiah brings water into the city of Jerusalem, and then in this brilliant move, he'll actually cover the Gihon spring outside of the city. So he'll cover it with rocks, he'll cover it with earth. And so when Assyria shows up, they lay siege to the city. Assyria doesn't have access to water because they don't even know the spring's there. But the people inside the city in Jerusalem who should have no access to water, they're living on day 4 and day 5 and month 6 and month 10 because Hezekiah redirected a spring so it would not water the Assyrians or later the Babylonians. Instead, he redirected it into the city of Jerusalem so that they could survive. Brilliant, brilliant feat of engineering. It's incredible. But Hezekiah would do something before the siege starts, right? You don't start building a tunnel. You don't start building the tunnel during the siege. You start building the tunnel way before the siege so that when the pressure mounts, when the siege happens, you've already been doing something. A non-glamorous thing, right? Digging a tunnel underground in the ancient world without the access of headlights and headlamps, and like, how are you doing that? And it's going to feel like slow, methodical, day after day, you gain a half an inch and you gain an inch. And each time you just show up and you do a little bit more and a little bit more. And what they did is they built a system that when siege happened, when trouble came, they had already done some things to prepare so that they would be okay. I want to talk a little bit about what it means to dig tunnels. They heard it was coming, they grabbed a bunch of shovels. I wonder if for us in our lives, if one of the things that we might be able to do to prepare for those moments when like the walls are pressing on us isn't also to grab a bunch of shovels, to do some things, to take on some patterns, some rhythms, some habits, to prepare us, to do some formation work in us so that we have something to rely on when the bottom falls out. Let me give you an example. I wonder if for some of us, establishing a regular rhythm of prayer is a way of digging a tunnel. That yes, you can wait, you can start praying when it all falls apart. Absolutely do that. But I wonder if bringing a regular habit of praying when it feels just monotonous and sometimes you don't even know if you want to, but establishing a rhythm of prayer could be digging a tunnel. It could be about the work of formation so that then when it all falls apart, you have something that you're able to fall back on. I wonder for some of us if friendship, relationships. Last week, we looked at like these four main relationships that we suggest every person have. You can wait until things fall apart and you need to have that community of people who are close to you, who are able to speak in. You can wait and you can try to build that when it falls apart. But what if you start investing in the right types of relationships and friendships, and you start pouring into people who you know in the moments you'll need, because you'll need it, that they're able to pour into you, and you can start developing those friendships and those relationships already so that when it falls apart, you have something to fall back on. I think the process of tunnel digging is the process of formation, of doing the things before we might even need it, in a way of forming a character within us. I think for some of us, like, generosity is a habit of tunnel digging, of reminding ourselves that, like, we don't need to white-knuckle life, right? That we so quickly want to just white-knuckle things and just declare everything mine, and yet maybe the act of regular generosity is the act of loosening that grip, of reminding ourselves that we're not in control, that we're held by someone who's bigger than us, who's got us, and that we can actually give some of it away and actually find freedom in it. I wonder, for some of us, tunnel digging is just taking on those rhythms, those routines, those habits. For me, one of the tunnels that I like to dig, I have a day every week that I declare is Sabbath. It's for me, it's Friday. Friday is the day that, like, the things that I would normally call work. On Friday, I try as hard as I can not to touch them. And I don't always do it perfect, right? The goal of digging a tunnel, the goal of this isn't perfection. It's formation, right? It's giving yourself to something over and over again as a way of forming. And so on Friday, I don't do anything that I'd call work. And what it does, what I hope it does, is it creates something in me where I recognize that my identity is not tied to what I do, right? I cannot show up and the world keeps spinning without me or in spite of me or however I want to say it, that I'm loved, I have value apart from what I'm able to produce or what I'm able to do, that Sabbath is a way of tunnel digging. So I wonder what might be something, what might be the thing that you could give yourself to now? Because the thing about tunnel digging, the thing about Hezekiah's tunnel is that it wasn't glamorous work. And it really wasn't even public work. It wasn't even something they did out in the open. It was something they did in the dark, underground, day after day after day, consistently showing up and showing up in a way that when they needed it, the work they did now matters. So I wonder for us this morning, if you're in a space, if you're in that space where it feels like the walls are pressing in, where it feels like you're surrounded, where it feels like you're in a tough space, maybe for you the response is not to withdraw or to isolate. Maybe for you, maybe the best thing you can do this week is simply like send out a text to somebody who you care about, who cares about you. Shoot a phone call. Let somebody know that you're hurting, that things are hard, and invite them into the story. Maybe for you the next thing that you can do is just take that first step, whatever that looks like. And then for all of us, whether you're in a spot where you feel like you're surrounded and it's pressing in or you're not, what's maybe one of those tunnels, a habit, one routine, rhythm that you could start this week that you could use to build something in you to be the type of person who withstands when those moments come? Would you pray with me? God, we are grateful that we know from the story that we are never alone, that you are always, always with us, that you are for us, that you are with us. And so, God, we pray that for those of us whom we're in a season right now where life is hard, God, we pray that we would resist the lies, that the enemy might tell us that this is all it's ever going to be, that there is no hope, that it will never be better. But God, we trust you, that you are good, that you are always working on our behalf. And God, we pray that you would open our eyes to see the tunnels, to see those habits, those patterns, those routines, rhythms that we might be able to take on in our lives so that you might be able to work through those to mold us more and more like Jesus. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.